In Joshua chapter 5, we've camped on verse 1 for quite a while and really looked at this theme of holy war and what it points to. And what we find is, as we continue to read in chapter 1, that the parents of these who have been carried across the Jordan River, they were not allowed to enter the promised land. Why? Because of their rebellion against God. They were not worthy, if you will, of the holy war. They had the holy war poured out upon them because they would not identify themselves with God and with His inheritance. And what we find is that their rejection of God has left their children in a state of shame. They've left them in a state of threat, actually, of being cut off from the people of God and from the blessings and benefits of God's grace. And so what we find today is this, that Jesus Christ removes our shame so that we can live as children of God again. Jesus Christ removed their shame and He removes our shame so that we can live as children of God again. So let's get right into our text. And this is the first point, that the church has a reason to rejoice in Yahweh. Look at verse 1. Now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard how Yahweh had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. The church has a reason to rejoice in Yahweh. When you go to the commentators, almost every single one of them are shocked and surprised. They think that it's strange for Israel to have the upper hand here against these kings and to, from a human perspective, to not be involved in war strategy, but instead to stop and involve themselves in covenant rituals. And that may be the case. I mean, what we find in chapter 5 is circumcision and Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then Joshua meets Jesus himself, the keeper of the covenant. But why do they think it's strange? It's because they think in terms of war strategy. But is that the primary thing that the land of Canaan is for these people? No, it's an inheritance. It's an inheritance. And so if you're going to receive an inheritance, what do? You spend time thinking about the one who has given you the inheritance. And so it's not strange at all that these people are celebrating God and His condescension toward them. Children, condescension, you know that big word? It's when you're playing on the floor and you want your dad or your mom to come down and play with you. They condescend down to your level and they will play with you. That's what God has done with His people, Israel, all this time. He's gone with them into the wilderness. And finally, He brought them here. And He dried up that pregnant, flooded Jordan River. Dried it up for miles. And Israel smoothly passed through the other side. They had a reason to rejoice. Rahab, if you remember, will report to the spies who were in Jericho. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For Yahweh your God, He is the God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. The people of Jericho, their hearts melted. They were afraid. But what about the kings? Maybe the kings were thinking, oh, that Jordan River is so flooded. It's got to hold back those Israelites at least for months. At least for weeks. It will buy us some time. But no, one day. One day, the whole thing's gone. They're moved right in front of it and it comes back. And so now the kings of the land, not just the people, but the kings of the land fear. They have a reason to rejoice. The children of Abraham have been waiting for over 400 years for this moment to be free and upon their own land of promise. Their God keeps His promises. They have reason to rejoice. And Yahweh has been speaking of possessing their inheritance. But there's a problem. There is a shame that is crushing them under its burden. Verse 9 refers to it this way. There is a reproach of Egypt upon you. And we'll take up the reproach of Egypt, but first notice what God's remedy is. To remove this reproach, He would order their circumcision. In verses 2 and 3. Look with me at verses 2 and 3. At that time, Yahweh said to Joshua, "Make for yourselves flint knives. Circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time." So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Ha'aralot. And so what we find here is that the church has a reason to be humbled. They had a reason to rejoice, but now they have a reason also to be humbled by their neglect of circumcision. And if you know about circumcision, you should be thinking this. What? They didn't circumcise their children? What? And if you don't know, that's okay, because we're going to look at it. What is circumcision? Circumcision is found in Genesis chapter 17, verses 1 through 14. We won't take time to read the whole thing right now. But it's in Genesis 17, that's where we find God establishing circumcision. But listen to verses 7 and 8. "And I, the Lord, will establish my covenant between me and you and your children after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your children after you. And I will give to you and to your children after you the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." You see that the land was tied to this actual sign of circumcision. God goes on to say what they were to do. "Every male among you shall be circumcised." That is, the foreskin should be cut off. "It shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. All 8-day-old males in your household, whether son or servant, shall be circumcised. You will wear an everlasting covenant symbol in your flesh." And then we get to verse 14. "Any uncircumcised male who's not circumcised in the flesh shall be cut off from his people. He's broken my covenant." See, if you will not cut off the foreskin, you will be cut off. Well, what's the significance then of the circumcision? If you've heard it, as I was reading it, covenant keeps coming up again and again. Covenant, covenant, covenant. This is a signature of God's covenant. What is the covenant that He's talking about here? It is God's condescending posture in order to save sinners. It's really that simple. It is God's relationship with sinners in which He comes lovingly and mercifully to restore you and to bring you back into a reconciled relationship with Him. That's covenant. I think sometimes because the word is not used very common today, we don't know exactly how to understand covenant. But we're covenant creatures. We are a people of covenant all the time. Do you have a bank account? Do you have a credit card? Do you have to hand in homework for school? Are you married? Do you have loans out for college? All of these are covenants. They are contracts. And in some ways, they're pictures of God's covenant. But God, and the way in which he approaches us is completely different. God approaches us on his own initiative, despite our deserving it. And God comes to us by his own strength. He would mercifully deliver his enemies from themselves and from their rebellion. That is covenant. So how does circumcision then point to this covenant? Well, by representation. You see, the promise is that he would send a seed, he would send a son by the shedding of his blood, by him being cut off, we would be saved. By him being cut off, by him receiving the knife, God's justice would be satisfied. Also, circumcision is a confirming of the covenant. It distinguishes those who are part of the covenant community, those who are in relationship with God, versus those who are not in relationship with God. There should be a distinction between those who are of Israel and those who are of Canaan. Another way is that circumcision signifies the covenant. In the sacrifice of Jesus, God reconciles sinners to himself. And what is his promise? The signification of circumcision, as we read in Romans, is that your heart would be circumcised. You've got a hardened heart. Your natural posture towards God is one of rebellion. And what you need is a heart of flesh. You need that hardness to be removed. Listen to what God says in the days of Moses, just prior to them crossing the Jordan River. And Yahweh your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your children, so that you will love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. Your problem is you don't love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and God would actually do a spiritual surgery in you so that you would love him. That's circumcision. In the New Testament, Colossians 2, this is what Paul says. In Christ also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. And so whether Old Testament or New Testament, we're still looking at this idea of God's spiritual work in you. Also, circumcision points to the new life. That is, that there would be effectual blessings and benefits secured and provided by the Holy Spirit through faith. Circumcision was a symbol of everlasting home for you. Circumcision was a symbol of everlasting family for you. Circumcision was a symbol of everlasting communion with God for you, because it was a symbol of the covenant. And so circumcision was really pointing to everything that God had done for you. It didn't point to your faith. It pointed to the work of God in your life. Well, then, if that's the case, what did it mean to be uncircumcised? To be uncircumcised, to not take upon you the covenant sign, or for your parents not to give you the covenant sign, it means that you had forfeited land inheritance. You were homeless. It means that you were excommunicated from your people. You had no family. You had no culture. You had no ethnicity now tied to the covenant and to God. To be uncircumcised was a loss of identity as a child of God. You had no father. You were an orphan. These are all the significations of being uncircumcised. And this is a terrible state. And you may be asking yourself, what does it have to do with me? Circumcision has none of these significances today. We don't do any of this. Well, it would be like not being baptized. Does that shock you? Does that cause you to think, what a terrible state to not be baptized? Not because baptism does anything to you, it doesn't save you, but it signifies all of the same things. And so are you in covenant with God? Are you one of His covenant people or not? Are you homeless? Are you familyless? Are you peopleless? Are you fatherless? This is how Paul continues in Colossians 2. Having been buried with Him in baptism, in which you were also raised with Him through faith, in the powerful working of God who raised Him from the dead. What's the significance of that? It's this, that Paul puts together the sign of circumcision, or the significance of circumcision, and the significance of baptism, and says that they point to the same thing. That while this one points to the putting off of the body of the sins of the flesh, this one points to being buried with Him and also risen with Him. Having new hearts, being raised from the dead. These are the signs of the covenant. This is the sign of God's operation for His people. And so the removal of sin in this old covenant context is signified by an event of humiliation. To be circumcised is an event of humiliation. You know, no one thinks, think of an adult male just for a minute. No one thinks, oh, to have your wisdom teeth pulled out, that'd be embarrassing. Now think of an adult who has to go in for surgery to be circumcised. It's embarrassing. There's some humiliation involved. You don't just go around saying, hey, pray for me, I'm going to go in and get circumcised. See, you kind of smile because it's like, it's uncomfortable. Right? Yeah. There's some humiliation that's involved in this. Which brings me to my third point, that the church has a reason to be ashamed of their sin. Look at verses 4 through 7. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt, who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along the way, after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way, as they came out of Egypt, had not been circumcised. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished, because they did not listen to the voice of Yahweh, to whom Yahweh had sworn that He would not let them see the land which Yahweh had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Their children, whom He raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised them, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. Well, just having a conversation then about what circumcision is, the obvious question is, why? Why did they not circumcise their kids? Why did they keep from them the sign of the covenant? Why did they keep from them the sign of what they needed God to do in their hearts and in their lives? Why did they keep the gospel from them? Calvin says this, here is the symbol of adoption to which they owed their freedom. What's wrong with them? Don't they know that God had said, if you do not circumcise your sons, they will be cut off from your people? There's a real threat here. It's as if God, now think about this, it's as if God had providentially suspended circumcision for a time, lest it be profaned. they were not circumcising their children because they were disobeying God. They would not hear His voice. They would not obey His voice. But providentially, God was actually withholding the sign from them so that they would not destroy the sign of the gospel. He wouldn't even let them see the gospel as a punishment for their sin, as the fruit of their own rebellion and unbelief. You notice in verse 6 here, it says, because they did not shema the voice of Yahweh. Shema is a Hebrew word. It has a dual meaning in it. It means to hear, but it also means to obey. And that's why translations will have to pick one or the other. See, because if you're really hearing your parents, it can be found in the fact that you're doing what they say to do, right? If you are not doing what they say to do, then you're probably not hearing or listening to them. Shema is a great word. And because of them being rebellious towards God, what was the response? Egypt mocking them. Can you hear Egypt mocking the Israelites as they wandered around in a circle for 40 years? Oh, their God, He took them out in the wilderness to die, didn't He? He couldn't even deliver them from themselves. Ha! You know, we told them, stay here. We'll take care of you. We'll provide for your labors. But no, they had to go their own way. And so all 2 million of them just left. And we had to let them go to learn the hard way. Can you hear the mocking of Egypt? The reproach of Egypt. The disgust of Egypt. And it's because of their own rebellion. They brought this upon themselves. Think about reproach for a minute. Disgust, contempt. We don't use the word reproach very often in our modern language. But contempt or disgust, we understand that word. John Gottman, he's a professor at the University of Washington. And he does a lot of research in regards to marriage. He analyzes married couples. He watches their videotaped conversations. Just small, short accounts. And it's amazing because he claims that he can predict marriage trouble merely by hearing just a brief snippet of their conversation. He listens to these four things. He listens for defensiveness, stonewalling, criticism, and contempt. Reproach. He says that contempt is insulting comments in which one partner, in a stance of superiority, puts down their counterpart, their spouse. Now think about this. He also can predict, if he hears contempt, he can also predict how many colds the receiving spouse will receive or will have. Let's see if I have that right. If contempt infects a marriage, it can predict the number of colds the receiving spouse may suffer. In other words, what he's saying is this, that receiving contempt will stress even the recipient's immune system. That's the power of contempt. That's what Israel was under. And to a large degree. But Yahweh is not done fulfilling His promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. Did you notice the double oath, the double swearing in verse 6? Because they would not listen, Yahweh swore that they would not see the land that He swore to their fathers. God will keep His promise. He swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your children will see the promised land. But you, your particular generation, no. You'll be cut off. God keeps His word, both positive and negative. So that nation perished. Literally, they were finished. They were finished because it's to make a distinction here in verse 6. with verse 8. There was a nation that was finished in judgment and another nation that was finished in circumcision, completed in covenant renewal. This is why we see the recircumcision a second time in verse 2. You see why God wanted to wait for their circumcision until after they crossed the Jordan River? A lot of people, again, looking at the war strategy, say it would have been so much easier if, on the safe side, they could have just circumcised, got healed, and then crossed. But no. God was in control, and He wanted to demonstrate a few things. First of all, that He was the one who would remove the reproach, the mocking of Egypt. This is a sign that the 40 years are ended. 40 years of wandering is because of the rebellion, but you're a new generation, and I will take you in. The reproach has been removed. But also, He had a promise in chapter 17 of Genesis. Only the circumcised will inherit the land. So I need to take you in and have you be circumcised so that you may inherit this land that I've given you. The reproach will be removed. And Yahweh would strengthen their conviction in Him versus the unbelief of their parents, because He would do it on the safe side. I'm sorry, on the trial side, on the threatening side. The reproach would be removed. Think about that. Just as Jesus Christ removed our shame by suffering shame on a cross, so He would remove their shame with a symbol of the cross, circumcision. And this Israel too, this second generation, would bring shame upon themselves. They would be no different from their parents. They would need to be replaced with a future seed, a future generation, one who would actually obey the will of his father. Which brings me to my last point, that the church has a reason to remember how Jesus delivered sinners. Look at verses 8 and 9. Now when they had finished circumcising all the nation, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. And Yahweh said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. So here they are, they need to heal, and they remain camped in Gilgal. If you remember way back, we talked about those stones, the 12 stones that were pulled out of the Jordan River. They were placed here at this national park, Gilgal. Here's a national park. God is demonstrating these are the works of salvation. And now God will attach a second memorial to Gilgal with a second meaning. Remember that Gilgal means literally rolling away, or rolling, or hill, or I'm sorry, not hill, wheel. And so there's the 12 stones out of the Jordan River, and now there is this circumcision which rolls away or removes the reproach of Egypt. What is God saying here? Don't forget my covenant. Here's a national park of remembrance. The stones are here. I carried you through the Jordan River, just like I carried you through the Red Sea. Remember. Circumcision is here. This is the land of promise. And also, attached to that promise is a promise seed. Remember my covenant. They will celebrate the Passover here. I delivered you out of slavery by killing the firstborn. Remember my covenant. It's here that they will pick their first grain and celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread. God provides a land flowing with milk because there's cattle, and honey because there's flowers. You see, God's covenant is your redemption. That's the point over and over again. But there's another place that's named here. Not just Gilgal, but Gibeah Ha'aralot, which is literally the hill of the foreskins. The hill of the foreskins. It created a hill. That should not be translated as a name. It's not Gibeah Ha'aralot. It should literally just be translated the hill of foreskins, because that's what it created, a hill of foreskins. And that should make you maybe a little embarrassed, a little uncomfortable. Why do you got to keep saying foreskins? But you see, this is a picture of the cross. This is a picture of the shame that Jesus Christ took upon himself. Jesus Christ was made sin and cut off at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the hill of reproach and disgust. And God has made it a hill of salvation. He has taken your disgust and your sin and put it away. By being put to shame, Jesus Christ put shame to death. That's why the cross is so embarrassing to the Jews. I don't think we really get it. We always have like a little cross, a little sunset in the background. No. It's the hill of the skull. It's the hill of death. What is beautiful about death? Nothing. It is so unnatural. It is the fruit and result of your sin and your rebellion against God. It's disgusting. And it is a reproach against God. And He desires to remove it. That's the beauty of the cross. And the world looks at this cross and they're confused. You know why? Because they're still trying to hide their shame and their guilt. And if you, Christians, are still trying to hide your shame and your guilt, then you're just like the world. And you're just like the old Israel wandering in the desert, despising the covenant and the covenant blessings and benefits. The world already mocks the church. And the church does not need to be embarrassed by the gospel too. Now Jesus removes our shame so that we can live as children of God again. We don't need to be ashamed of the grace and the mercy of God, nor by the means by which He deals with our sin and rebellion. We will only have a place within this kingdom of God if we're united to His obedient Son, the Son who bears shame in His hands and in His feet in order to remove your shame. So those united to Jesus by faith are also circumcised in the heart, in order that you may be equipped to fight spiritual warfare just like this generation here. He bids you come to Him by faith. Come, enter into His humiliation, that you may enter into His exaltation. That's the call. The old prophets would say, circumcise your hearts. Tear your hearts and not your garments. That's the call to us this day. May Jesus Christ, by His Spirit, circumcise our hearts and raise us again to new life in His baptism. Amen.